And so it begins.
And now, here with an unlimited supply of misinformation, is Mr. Know-It-All.
John, I love your show.
Here we go. Okay, 109, talking to the microphone, John. Hi, it's John Williams, and I'll be here until 3, today and tomorrow and the next day and the next day, and as long as they let me play on WGN again. How about them apples? I'm looking at the face of Elif Garris. She is my new producer. Elif, congrats, and welcome to the show. And Benji's sitting behind me. He's going to make sure I hit all the buttons right, because while I have worked on this radio station almost continually for the last 20 years, I have been out of this studio for the last few. So it's been a while since I've been pushing the buttons. So if you hear things go badly, at least mechanically, that's my fault. If you hear things go bad intellectually or verbally, I guess that's also my fault. So lots to do on the show today. A little bracket talk for me. That's what everybody does. It's the law. I want to talk a little bit about the health care plan that the president has and where that is today. And the Darty Joel Stein has been a frequent guest on this show over the years. He's got the cover story in Time magazine. We'll talk to him about Snapchat in the next half hour. And by the way, I don't know if you and I have had much time on the air together, Ryan, but welcome to you to me.
Well, thank you very much. Did they change any of the buttons on you?
Well, that's what Benji said. Ben says, it's all the same. And I go, yeah, but I forgot everything.
It's so a little bit of hazing.
Really, yeah. That doesn't help. I'm surprised that he didn't remember that about me. We went to the Blackhawks game yesterday, which was a lot of fun. I mean, the Wild were in town. You know, I just came back from Minneapolis, so I have a lot of family and friends up there, and I know a little bit about the Minnesota Wild. And when I heard the Wild were going to play the Blackhawks on Sunday at 11:30 in the morning, for crying out loud, I was lucky enough to be able to get tickets. So that was kind of a fun part of the day yesterday. We got in the Uber here at the Tribune Tower. Me and some friends and I met here at the station. Actually, we were in front of the Hotel Intercontinental, and we were going to get a cab. And the guy that flags cabs said, oh, where are you going? I'll get a guy. And suddenly a black SUV pulls up, and I thought, oh, no, this is going to be very expensive. And I said, how much to United Center? And he said, $25. And my buddy looks at me from Minneapolis, and he goes, oh, hey, that sounds high. And I said, yeah, I think it is a little high. I said, we'll do 20, but I can't do 25. He said, no, forget it. And I said, well, then that's okay. So we got in an Uber instead. And as we're driving out, I'm sitting in the front seat. And the guy looks at my hand and he says, oh, you're wearing gold. And I said, yeah, I am. And he said, in my country, the men never wear gold. I said, where are you from? He said, Sudan. I said, is that a Sudanese thing or is that a Muslim thing? He says, Muslim men never wear gold. I said, I hadn't thought about that. I hadn't noticed that. He said, oh, yeah, it's forbidden. I said, Muslim women wear gold. He said, oh, yeah. He said, when I got married, I had to round up $10,000 worth of gold for my wife. I said, yeah, I've heard a little bit about that. Really, $10,000. Is what you gave to your wife. And I said, and then she wears it? And he said, yeah, she looks great. Lovely, he said. I said, that's really cool. I said, yeah, no, we don't do that here. I said, you know, we spend the money on the diamond, maybe a little bit of gold, but there's no sort of obligation or commitment. And obviously the men can wear the gold. And then, kind of out of the blue, but the conversation was sort of going in this direction, he asked us what we thought about Donald Trump. And so that's always a kind of moment of truth when somebody asks that, but they don't tip their hand. But I think I knew how he felt, and some of the people in the vehicle expressed their opinions about Donald Trump, pro or con, whatever. And then he said, well, he said, I have two kids that were born here in the United States. They're ages 3 and 5. They're born here. They live with me here in one of the suburbs. And my wife went to Sudan and was flying back to see us to come back to Chicago. And when she landed, that was the day of the travel ban, and she couldn't get off the plane. You know how you hate flying from here to L.A. because it's 3 hours, and really it's 4 hours. Can you imagine traveling internationally like that? You land, and then they say, guess what? You can't stay, and you have to get on the next flight, and you have to leave. And so she did. And then this week, he said, his wife is finally able to come back, he thinks, and that's going to cost him again. I said, oh, yeah, they don't reimburse you for that. He said, no, she flew, so she used the ticket. The airline doesn't care that she didn't stay, so then she flew back. And now he said it's costing me $2,700. He must have mentioned $2,700 to us three or four times in the car. And I said, yeah, that's the way it goes. And then there was much political discussion that ensued with our Uber driver on the way to the game. Steve Bertrand, is that you over in the newsroom over there?
Hello, John Williams.
Nice to see and hear your voice, my friend.
It's good to see you, too.
It's just an interesting conversation we were having because I said, oh, we've heard about you people. You people meaning those of you who literally got caught up that day of the travel ban, the first one, obviously. I said, we'd heard about that, but I'd never met or talked to somebody who was, you know, patient zero. That's you. He said, yeah, I really hate Donald Trump. I said, well, I understand how you feel about that. I mean, that's tough.
And the real people, that you had an experience that a lot of us didn't have, you know, to actually talk to someone who was truly impacted that way.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, you know, his children are U.S. citizens, and I'm not sure what his status is. His wife was a green card holder, but, you know, he seemed to be he said, I love this country. And he seemed to be very passionate and very informed and very positive, but also very upset for very personal reasons about what's going on that path. So we go to the game, and that was a lot of fun. The Blackhawks scored in the first 51 seconds of the game. If you heard or listened to the game or saw the game, you know that. And then in the third period, the Wild scored within the first minute. I was on briefly with Steve Cochran today, and we're talking to Coach Q, and I said, Coach, is that common? Like, what is the magical moment when most goals are scored? And I would imagine it's not in the first minute of a game. My guess is that most goals are scored later in the game, after the guys have sort of loosened up. I don't know what happens. He said, no, I don't know. He said, maybe in the last minute of game, but that's when goalies are pulled. If you're talking 5-on-5, I don't know. I said, you guys should find that out. My guess is that in a hockey game, there is a golden spot where, and I don't know what period it is, and I don't know what minute it is, but there must be a time in all hockey games where the most goals are scored.
In this era of data, I can't believe they don't know that.
How does some cybermetric hockey guy not have that? And then, Steve, I started thinking this about baseball. In fact, I was trading text today with Pete McMurray, and he said, yep, never thought about this. I said, Pete, you should think about this. I think this is fascinating. He said, not so much. I said, when in a baseball game is the batting average of any given player or team the highest? I'm guessing it's the fourth or seventh inning. But I would love somebody to know that, because then when you send the players up, go, all right, we know that you saw that pitcher the first time, but when you come back up in the fourth inning, you know, then you're going to be seeing him the second time,
right?
And he's a little worn down. And so I'll bet that somebody out there must know in what inning, how many outs, what count is the batting average of a player the highest?
Well, it would also change by pitcher, right? Because they always say that about young pitchers, that they've got the benefit of the first time through the order.
Yeah, right, sure, absolutely.
Time.
Well, that's why I'm thinking fourth inning, maybe seventh inning if the starter's gone that long.
But a lot of great pitchers, they say if you don't get to them early, they'll shut you down. So they would give up more runs early.
Okay, well, then maybe my theory isn't so good, but the statistic has to exist. I mean, at some point, the batting averages of Major League Baseball players must be the highest. So when is that? What inning with how many outs in a given baseball game is, on average, the baseball team batting's average the highest? That's a quantifiable fact. And now I found myself wanting to know it. So I was going to tell Elif to look it up, my producer, but I thought, I don't even know what I just said. I don't know what she now has to look up.
I think it's after 4 1/3.
You did not just find that.
No, I didn't. But I'm going to say that
Well, that's my guess, too.
The first batter after the first out in the fourth inning gets a hit more often than any other position.
I believe that, Steve. That would be my guess. But now I want you to prove that to me because I want to know that fact.
It's different times. I don't have to prove anything.
I know. You can't just say it and then say, well, the correct answer now is, well, then disprove it.
I want you to investigate it.
No, disprove it, because you don't know that that's not true.
It could be true.
It might be true. We're going to go with that until you tell me otherwise.
My responsibility.
It's eighth inning and ninth inning, you figure, well, they've got relief pitchers out there or, you know, good second relief pitchers, so it's probably not there. So I'm guessing it's then somewhere between the fourth and the eighth, probably the fourth and the seventh. But Ella, if you'll have, and so then I told Coach Q, I said, I told Dave Ennett, I'm telling you, Steve, somebody should look this up, because then you tell your guys, okay, guys, we're late in the first period. There's 5 minutes left. On average, this is when hockey teams score the most. The goalie's getting a little tired, and I don't know what the thought process is.
Buckle down.
So buckle down. Now go get them.
Change your line more quickly.
Whatever it is that you have to do, you could maybe make defensive adjustments as well, but I'd
put a guy in short center.
you're not talking hockey now, sure, but I get you. That's kind of my thought about this. And that's pretty much all I got for you there, Steve. That's just one.
Well, thanks for coming by. I look forward to tomorrow.
That's today's show. Joel Stein will say hi to us in a little while. We'll be talking about Snapchat. He's on the cover of that magazine. One last note, though, and I don't talk sports that often. I shouldn't have gone down this road today, but it is on my mind. The brackets are everywhere. A friend of mine sent me an email, and he's the kind of guy who literally doesn't know the rules of baseball and basketball. He, not that long ago, and this is a man in his 50s, said, so does the first baseman bat first and then the second baseman bat second? And I said, no, that's at the manager's discretion. He goes, oh, okay. Like he just picked up a nuance of the game, you know? Like I had just told him that in the fourth inning, batting averages are high. But this same guy then said, hey, I'm in a bracket at work, which just, you know, I hope cracks you up too. And he said, can you give me some tips on how to do this? He said, I'm thinking about going alphabetical. Judy Markey would appreciate that, right, Steve? And then he said, but I may change my teams to, in each bracket, what city would I rather live in? Which would be kind of fun. If you don't know anything about the teams, but you it's easy maybe to root for North Carolina over Philadelphia or something like that. That's assuming he knows where Villanova is. I think that would require more research than he's willing to do.
Have a lookup machine.
But I did find a couple of, I think, very understandable, usable factoids that you can write down. I posted them on Facebook last night. Actually, I posted it on Facebook last night, realized that I got a statistic wrong, and then thought, what's a talk show host to do? I deleted it, fixed it, and now I have the goods. And I'll get to that next on WGN. I don't know that I'm going to get to my stats now on how to best pick the NCAA brackets. They're on my Facebook page and King John on Facebook. Steve Bertrand's in the newsroom.
Yeah,
what's up, Steve?
Some sad news for many, particularly you, John. Amy Krauss Rosenthal, the Chicago writer, who was on your show many times, and it was gained great attention within the past couple of weeks with an essay she wrote, has passed away. She'd been terminally ill for some time, leaves behind her husband Jason, died today at the age of 51.
That piece, to say it went viral, so trivializes what that was all about, but it was widely shared and read. It was one of the most clicked on things on the New York Times when she posted it. It was strange because she wrote
it. Well, you know what? Can I interrupt you?
Sure.
It went more than viral because it was the sort of thing that people, they weren't emailing me or Facebook. They were coming up to me and saying, hey, did you read this?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was a water cooler too.
It really was. And it was, here's my understanding of that, Steve. It read like she wrote that around Valentine's Day, but it didn't get posted on the New York Times until just a week ago or so. I don't know why the delay took place. But obviously, when she wrote it, she knew that her health was failing. And the New York Times finally published it just before in the Lives section of the Sunday New York Times a couple of weeks ago. They just published it. And then, obviously, she shortly thereafter has passed away. The gist of it was she knows that she's dying. She loves her children and husband. And she didn't address her children too much in this piece, which is understandable, perhaps. But she knew that she was leaving behind a great guy. And so this was almost like an ad online to date her husband. And while she knew he wouldn't write it, she did for him. And then she said, what a wonderful man he is. What a touching concept. And then she found the words to say remarkable things. And then she did something clever at the end, too. She left a space. She said, this is for you, where you and he can get together. I mean, like if it were printed on a page, a quarter of the page was blank, and she said, this is for you. She wrote, the first book that she wrote that I kind of fell in love with her and fell in love with was the book where she wrote, it was a biography, but she wrote it as an encyclopedia. You remember that, right, Steve?
Yeah, right. Because she was, I don't think I ever met her, but I met her through you, I think, a few times. She was very quirky, right?
Oh, Lord, yeah.
Almost a performance artist sometimes.
Oh, very much so. I think that's, I don't know how she would have felt about my describing her that way, but that's what it was, because a lot of the things she did were stunts. Meet me at the Bean with the yellow umbrella, and we will do things you can't imagine that will put positive energy in the world. I was always on board her stuff. I was always promoting it and giving it a thumbs up. Half the time, I didn't know what we were doing. You know, I'm like, okay, I don't know what this is, Amy. I know you just explained it to me. I'm still not sure what it is, but I know your heart is in the right place and my head isn't fast enough to stay with you. But people showed up and they did her stuff, and her books, children's books and adult books, were gifts from Amy Krauss Rosenthal to all of us. Did they list her age, Steve, in the piece that you saw?
51 years old.
Yeah, too young. She died of cancer, and I guess I knew the day it was coming. And she clearly did, too. The piece is titled, thanks, Elif, You May Want to Marry My Husband. And it's dated March 3rd in the New York Times. Amy Krauss Rosenthal's You May Want to Marry My Husband. I mentioned this on my Saturday show not that long ago. I'll shut up here after I just read part of it. I'll just scroll over here to the last paragraph or so. Yeah, let me see if I actually do have the last paragraph here. You know, she called him a sharp dresser. He's a handyman. He's good with kids. My guess is she said that you know enough about him now, so let's swipe right. Wait, did I mention that he's incredibly handsome? I'm going to miss looking at that face again. Amy Krauss Rosenthal. This is John Williams. Joel Stein joins us in just seconds. The Darty Joel Stein, the Time Magazine columnist, cover story. But rather than go directly to him, which was my plan, what?
Hi, John.
Are we interrupting?
Bill and Wendy are here.
We showed
up. Hi, guys.
Up.
Thank you for letting me take your little two-hour window here.
Thank you for taking it.
Because it's haunted.
I love this. I'm happy to be here. It's so good to be back. But I know people who were so in your pocket were in the Bill and Wendy groove or listening to me going, oh, well.
They're horribly disappointed, John.
I think they are.
I've looked at the notes they've sent in, horribly disappointed. We're thrilled that you're back.
Yes, welcome
home.
We
really are.
Us LaGrangers got to stick together.
We do.
Yeah, it's good to be here. And it's nice to have Steve Bertrand there. My new producer is Elif. By the way, you sent me the most bizarre note about Elif.
Yes. I thought you needed to know some things about her before you hired her as your producer.
It was so weird because he gave Elif, the day that we decided to hire her, he gave me a handwritten note.
Mm-hmm. Which he taped shut, so I don't even know what it
says.
And
then handed to Elif,
yes,
and said, give this to John.
Right.
So she walks up to me and goes, Bill wants you to read this. And I open it up and it says, John, I just think you should know, Elif is a wonderful woman. But she bites people.
She's a biter?
She's a biter.
And that's why you hired her.
And then it went on with due seriousness about her chronic biting.
She bites a lot. I said that she has a propensity to start grease fires, unexplained grease fires. There's a lot of peculiar things that happen around Elif, and I just thought it was fair that you knew that.
Thank
about
you for
her.
Sharing that.
Sure.
That's real square of
yep.
you. Yeah. I have my guest I have to go to.
Go.
But anything else I can do for you guys in any way?
No. Welcome back.
Just do a good show.
That's all we ask.
Because we did.
Okay. Well.
That's funny.
You guys did. Do. So how do I put Joel on? He's on this line here, 7. Do
right.
I hit that? Or is Elif going to hit that? Joel, are you there?
Yeah. Can I talk to Bill and Wendy instead?
Yeah, Joel, hi.
Hey, Joel. We'll
welcome
just handle
aboard.
This interview, John. This you can sit back. We'll show you how it goes.
This hurts a lot.
Joel, treat John with the love and respect he richly deserves.
All right. If you guys aren't around, I'll do my best.
All right. Well, thanks, Joel.
Thanks
have
for coming
time.
In, kids.
James.
All right. This is John Williams. Joel Stein joins us in just seconds. The Darty Joel Stein, the Time Magazine columnist, cover story. But rather than go directly to him, which was my plan, what?
Hi, John.
Are we interrupting?
Bill and Wendy are here.
We showed
Hi, guys.
Up.
Thank you for letting me take your little two-hour window here.
Thank you for taking it.
Because it's haunted.
I love this. I'm happy to be here. It's so good to be back. But I know people who were so in your pocket were in the Bill and Wendy groove or listening to me going, oh, well.
They're horribly disappointed, John.
I think they are.
I've looked at the notes they've sent in. Horribly disappointed. We're thrilled that you're back.
Yes, welcome
we
home.
We really are.
Us LaGrangers got to stick together.
We do.
Yeah, it's good to be here. And it's nice to have Steve Bertrand there. My new producer is Elif. By the way, you sent me the most bizarre note about Elif.
Yes. Yeah. I thought you needed to know some things about her before you hired her as your producer.
It was so weird because he gave Elif, the day that we decided to hire her, he gave me a handwritten note.
Mm-hmm. Which he taped shut, so I don't even know what it says.
And then handed to Elif and said, give this to John.
Right.
So she walks up to me and goes, Bill wants you to read this. And I open it up and it says, John, I just think you should know, Elif is a wonderful woman, but she bites people.
She's a biter?
She's a biter.
And that's why you hired her.
And then it went on with due seriousness about her chronic biting.
She bites a lot. I said that she has a propensity to start grease fires, unexplained grease fires. There's a lot of peculiar things that happen around Elif, and I just thought it was fair that you knew that
about
her.
Thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
That's real square of
yep.
you. Yeah. I have my guest I have to go to.
Go.
But anything else I can do for you guys in any way?
No. Welcome back.
Just do a good show.
That's all we ask.
Because we did.
Okay. Well.
That's funny.
You guys did. Do. Back. Stand by for the Joel Stein theme song in 3, 2, 1.
This is a show about a scrawny guy named Joel Stein. In real life he writes for a magazine called Time. But now he's got his own cartoon show on VH1. In which he works for a TV show, a made up one. But even though the show has got a standard sitcom feel, all the interviews with famous people are for real. Joel likes to ask him questions that'll make him squirm. Sometimes he gets punched out, but Joel never learns. Hey Joel, what do you know? You got your own show. Try not to blow it, cause if you're not funny then you'll soon be gone. They can fill the time with some more Lenny Kravitz songs. Then you'll be back in obscurity where you belong.
And then they say, hey Joel.
Hey Joel.
It's the Joel Stein theme song. It's from a TV show of his. It was a cartoon show. It ran in Canada. It was summarily canceled, and now he has to write for a living. Joel, thanks for coming on again. How are you?
I'm so excited to be your first guest on your first day back.
Yeah, I guess technically you are. I didn't plan it that way, but...
I don't know if you need to say that.
I want that. Your Honor, I'd like to have that stricken from the records. It's an honor to have you on my show. But the timing works out because you have the cover story of Time magazine. I guess the first question, it's about Snapchat. It's a really good piece. But I guess the first question is, do you get paid extra when you write the cover story versus another story or column? How does that work?
And you know what? You're Bill and Wendy wouldn't have thought of that question. I think no one's ever asked me that.
Oh, no.
I get paid the exact same amount as if it were like a toy review. Not that Time does toy reviews, but no, yeah, I don't get paid extra.
Well,
I'm angry.
I'm sorry I even brought it up then. So is it like you're a staff writer and you just get paid to write and they use it as is necessary? Or how does that work?
Well, everyone would think that. And that was true for most of my career. But when I quit like 11 years ago. So I'm technically a freelancer. So I get paid by the word.
I see.
Which is why you'll notice there's a lot of does and ahs and ums in the story.
I noticed at the end you put the end in big letters the way we used to. We had to fill out a space on a high school or grade school term paper. It had to be two full pages.
And so space,
it really was. So Snapchat is fascinating for a couple of reasons. One, it's not a story about the president. I'm really happy about that. And then number two, it is different than Facebook and Twitter, and that was really the thrust of your piece. How is it different? What is Snapchat, and how is it different?
Well, for most people at this point, Facebook and Twitter and other social media are about, projecting your brand and gathering followers and getting likes and broadcasting, really.
Yeah.
What Snapchat is, you can do some of that kind of there, although they are really good about not letting you gamify it by telling you how many followers you have or, you can't comment or like. But the main function is not to publish or broadcast. The main function is to visually text, to chat with your friends, like the name says. Instead of Snapshot, it's Snapchat. So instead of the main metric for a user of Snapchat isn't the amount of followers or likes, it's this the length of their streak with their friends, which is having a friend talk to you or chat with you once a day. So it's really a means of communication.
Well, what's the content of those? Because on Facebook, it's, hey, I'm having a great day or something like that. Sometimes it's very mundane. But
this is more mundane. So Snapchat considers itself a camera company. So when you open Snapchat, you don't see a news feed. You just see a camera. And what you do is you take a picture of most likely yourself, but it could be something else. And then you can layer information on top of that by writing on it with your finger or by typing on top of it or putting stickers on it.
Right.
And it could be video or a photo. So it's a visual means of communication.
And is it one-on-one? Would I do it to everybody following me, or would I just snap to you?
I'd say 90% of the use is just snapping to me, although you have a little section, which Instagram has since copied, called My Story,
right,
which will last for 24 hours, and you can post things there that anyone can follow. But most of what you're doing is just sending something to another person, which they can look at once, and then it disappears forever.
Yeah, well, wasn't that the thrust of it originally, Joel? It was pictures that...
Still.
All right, but weren't they also at least perceived to be dirty pictures at first, or there was a lot of that going on at first?
Yeah, I think almost whenever a new technology comes out, people use it first for pornography. And even more so, people like to talk about its use for pornography. So I think even at the beginning, when people were talking about it that way, it was a single-digit percentage use of it. So mostly, it's that if you're like a 13-year-old girl, all of your energy and fear and anxiety is about your Instagram account. It's about if people like this picture that you put up and what their comments are and making yourself perfect. And there's so much anxiety that teenage kids right now, their depression rates are up, their suicide rates are up. And a lot of girls have a Finstagram account, which is a second fake. Or fake Instagram account, in which they can just kind of be themselves and only their friends know about it.
Huh.
So Snapchat is a way for you not to have to project perfection to all your teen friends.
Well, what you just said notwithstanding, I mean, you just said they're very anxious about, are people liking the pictures that they posted? And that's, I thought, part of the problem with Facebook. It becomes almost fake because people are so trying to project, hey, everything. Everybody gets depressed reading everybody else's fun times they're having on Facebook. Instagram is somehow different than that, Joel?
Worse. No, I think it's just like that. It's like this perfect piece of food I just ate and this perfect, I think everyone's probably still on a boat, right?
Yeah.
I've noticed on Snapchat, by the way, even though you're just snapping each other, the equivalent to being on a boat is at the airport. Like, if you are at an airport, apparently you have to snap it. Because there are these filters that geotag you so it can say where you are.
Uh-huh.
People are, even like powerful people, like senators, and are very impressed that they're at an airport. It's very strange.
All right, and I misspoke just now, but Snapchat is not like that. It doesn't seem to generate that sort of anxiety or that need to project something, huh?
No, because it disappears, right? So you're comfortable. Like, look, I'm not on a boat. I'm just sitting here watching TV, and you take a picture of yourself.
Yeah, but I mean, as a man who lives in front of a keyboard, you're a wordsmith, among other things, Joel.
Oh, yeah. Words are dead.
Well, yeah. You're all right. You're anticipating my question. Does it bother you a little bit that this is a hot means of communication among the next generation?
Yeah. I mean, I think between Gutenberg and now, we had a good run. probably before that, actually, right? Because, I mean, when people were far apart from each other, they had to communicate by letter. So, yeah, I think by nature, people like to talk and express themselves through body language. So it doesn't surprise me that I'm getting my butt kicked by people who don't want to type. You know, the emoticon was the first step. And now,
you know, it was. You know, and I don't like emoticons.
Horrifying.
I don't know why. I mean, this is one of the things I would change about myself, because I know I sound like I'm a troglodyte or a Neanderthal or something here. I never use the colon and the open or close parentheses to express an emotion. I would type out, I'm happy or I'm sad. And I don't know why I'm so belligerent about
it. I have a little pictures there for you.
I know, Doctor. Yep, I'm trying to tell you, though, that I don't like that. And I feel
me neither. Yeah.
It's kind of the end of the interview, then, I guess. We're sort of stuck in that spot.
No, I still respect you.
No, but I want to be on the bus. I just don't like the direction it's going. So there I am saying, well, you kids get off my lawn and use the Queen's English or whatever it is.
Yeah, well, but I'm not a visual person in general. So I like text. I mean, that's why I became a writer. So I think I'm just in the minority.
Well, I think the problem I have, too, or at least it sounds like I have, is that there's this air of superiority. And I don't mean that way. I literally mean I just feel like I'm being left out. And maybe I shouldn't.
You're a member of the elite.
Would you stop? Maybe I should stop judging that kind of communication. Snapchat, we're talking about with Joel Stein, who's got the cover story in Time magazine. I mean, it does take a certain skill set or maybe creative eye, Joel, to be a good Snapchat communicator.
Definitely. And at the same time, it is also true that people are becoming dumber. These are not separate things. You know, that said, I understand that visually texting can communicate a lot more information than a regular text. And I'm not so impressed by the writing in regular text, so I'm not so upset about it.
No.
But yes, on a separate level, people are becoming idiots.
Anything else on that happy note? Anything else that you have to pass along to us about the Snapchat phenomenon? It skews younger. The guy,
very young.
You wrote about the guy who created this. He and a partner, but he was offered $3 billion at the age of 23 for the company from Facebook. $3 billion. If I ever come home and one of my sons says, "Dad, Facebook offered me $3 billion," and I said, "No, they are in so much trouble," he says no to them. Then they do an IPO, or as I called it to my son the other day, an IPA. And and they're offered the valuation starts at $24 billion. What do they guess Snap, the parent company, is worth now?
North of 30 since the trading. But I think he turned down the $3 billion not because he thought he'd get 30 someday. He turned down the $3 billion because he was a 23-year-old kid who grew up rich and realized this was his chance to run a huge company and affect society. So I don't think if Facebook had offered him $30 billion, he would have taken it. I mean, he may have been forced to by his investors.
Yeah.
But he wanted to run a company. He knew that he was going to have enough money to live on the rest of his life between his dad and just the fact that he, you know, was a computer science developer. He was a product guy from Stanford and had started a company. Like, he wasn't worried about money.
Right.
He knew he was smart enough to know that, like, being a billionaire isn't any better than being, like, a 10-millionaire.
Right.
It doesn't really affect your life.
Yeah.
He wanted to, like, be able to call anyone in the world and meet with them. Like, he wanted that power.
All right, last question then. Just philosophically, is the world better or worse then for us having Snapchat?
I think better. I mean, I think Facebook is a real mess right now between fake news and people just yelling at each other. And, you know, you go on there to see, you know, find out when your friends' birthdays are. It's like a utility that no one enjoys. So I feel like this really lowers people's anxiety about projecting their brands, which is something I hate, their personal brands, even though I have one.
Once
people told me I did, I got mad at myself. So I think this is definitely an improvement.
I'll call you another day, Joel. Keep writing, even though you didn't get paid extra for the cover story, but it's a really good story.
I should get more.
Oh, yeah. Listen, next time, that's your assignment. Next time we talk, Joel, I want you to go, "John, I've been thinking about what you said, and now I'm getting paid a bonus for being the cover story in Time."
Do I get paid for this interview?
Got to run, Joel.
All right, bye.
It's Joel Stein from Time magazine. Steve, are you on any of those sites that we were talking about with Joel? Or do you use Snapchat?
I
have it on my phone.
Yeah, I do it, but I do it only to follow my daughter.
And so does she. Really? Well, that's nice.
So she'll post stories, and then I'll look at that. But
on Snapchat, you'll look at that.
On Snapchat, Instagram, too.
And do you Snapchat back to her?
Not so much. One time she sent me a Snapchat, and I texted her back, and she's like, "Are you kidding me?" So.
Yeah, you kind of got to be careful what you send to whom and when and how and where you send it.
Well, you know, as a parent, the Snapchat thing, like Joel was saying about how it disappears.
Yeah.
It's crazy. If your kid's at school and you want to see something and you've got 30 seconds to see it or it's gone. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't.
So it's like, "Here, Sharon, look at this."
I just don't see the utility.
Clock going away.
But you can capture that, though, if you want.
And you can do a screen save, I guess.
So literally, she sends you something that is important enough to her to send to you. Maybe it's not all that important, but she's Snapchatted with you.
More important to us, yeah.
And then it's gone. You go, "Oh, it's gone! Oh, geez, hurry. Run, Sharon, run! It's going to disappear!"
How do you screen save? Screen save?
All right, Steve. And you know, it's a friend of mine, His wife was celebrating her birthday the other day. This is just kind of an aside, but it's a little bit related. And he sent her the most loving text. You know, every day I fall more in love with you than the day before.
Mm-hmm.
Sent it to me.
Sweet. That's so nice.
It wasn't intended for me. It was the nicest thing.
I've written that for you, but I never send it. I always keep it. I think twice. Last minute thing.
And so it begins.
And now, here with an unlimited supply of misinformation is Mr. Know-It-All.
John, I love your show.
A lot of people say, John, why'd you come back? Say to play the temperature game with Steve Bertrand. You can text to 312-981-7200. Some of you are. This text says, I don't dislike John, but I much prefer Dave and Wendy. And Dave and Wendy will be on tomorrow morning, 10 to noon.
Or from noon to 1, you can listen on WGN Plus.
I understand some folks are actually having trouble accessing that today, and I'm sorry I'm not able to give you more information about that, but rest assured they'll get it fixed, or they won't, and then they won't do it.
Or just listen 12 to 1, and we'll give you the information as soon as we have it.
By the way, just some interesting text before we go to our guest real quick here, because it touches on a couple of things that we were talking about earlier. John, my favorite book when I was a baby and a toddler was Amy Krauss Rosenthal's. Steve, did you just mention her again in your last newscast?
I did not, no.
Amy Krauss Rosenthal, the much-loved artist and author in Chicago, has passed away. Many of us who follow her saw it coming. She had written about it, but she's died today of cancer. John, my favorite book when I had a baby, and toddler was Amy Krauss Rosenthal's. It was called The Same Phrase Describes My Marriage and My Breasts. Before the kids, they used to be such a cute couple. It's just a bunch of funny stories about her kids and marriage. Wonderful. I'm so sorry that she's gone. Yeah. Big fans here. And we're sorry to see that, too. And then about Joel Stein on a moment ago talking about Instagram. John, my wife and I are middle school teachers. My wife recently had a conversation with students about fake Instagram, where students represent a fake side of their life, and then they have a more intimate group with a different account that they shared with their other friends. They understand the difference. Yeah, interesting. It's 2:11 on WGN. This is John Williams. You now hear me weekdays from 1 to 3 and Saturdays from 10 to noon. It's good to be back. Mary Agnes Carey joins us now, partnerships editor and senior correspondent for Kaiser Health. You're going to pull her up for me right there, Elif. Mary Agnes, this is John Williams. How are you this afternoon?
I'm great, thank you.
I'm touching buttons I shouldn't be touching. Today was kind of an interesting day. First, for those of you who don't know Kaiser Health, tell us a little bit about your organization. What do you all do, Mary Agnes?
We're a national not-for-profit healthcare news service. We're an editorially independent program of the Kaiser Family Foundation. We're not affiliated with the insurance company Kaiser Permanente. And we place our stories in publications all over the country, including the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times, USA Today, and news outlets nationwide. So we are focused exclusively on healthcare policy and politics.
And not partisan that way?
Absolutely not. Not nonpartisan. Absolutely. We are not partisan in any manner. Rather, we are nonpartisan. We're just an objective source of healthcare information for folks.
I suppose other people will say that, and then somebody else will judge them to be failing that. I don't suppose any of us are perfect in that regard, but I appreciate that that's the objective. You're not rooting for either side in these debates.
I think you wouldn't have publications all over the country running our copy unless we were staunchly nonpartisan.
So was today a big day? I mean, wasn't the CBO supposed to give its scorecard on Obamacare Lite or Trump Care or whatever we're calling it?
They are. The Congressional Budget Office, also known as you mentioned, the CBO, is the congressional scorekeeper, and we are awaiting that information even as we speak. The thought was those numbers would come out today. We haven't seen them yet. They might still be released, but this is kind of the roadmap, if you will, on the Republican healthcare alternative. How much will it cost? How many people will it cover? How much will people's premiums change? Who might get coverage under, or who not receive coverage, rather, as
right,
well, under the Medicaid changes? So it's kind of, everyone's kind of looking at that to get this objective view.
It's a report, but do they give it an A+ or a 92 or something like that overall?
No, They just give numbers. They will say this many million people would gain or lose coverage. This is how what the effect is on the federal treasury. This is how it would change the Medicaid program. Mm-hmm. So it's more of a numbers report.
Sean Spicer and others are saying, though, the president's spokesperson and others, Kellyanne Conway, pick 'em, that the CBO failed, though, in sort of anticipating Obamacare. So, you know, be careful how much stock you put in their sort of assessment in advance of the Trump version. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, there's always going to be some margin for error, right? For example, the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, scored a higher number of people losing their employer health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. That was an area where they were off. As it turns out, most employers have kept people on their health insurance plans. They didn't dump them into the individual market. And other aspects, whether it's how much the bill has cost or some other enrollment figures, I think they've been pretty close. The number of the changes it would make on the Medicare program, for example, some of those Medicare cuts that mm-hmm. Republicans are retaining in the package. So it is by its nature an estimate. But the thought here is that having such a uniform presentation from the Trump administration that the numbers are going, you know, that you can't trust CBO or they're bad at their jobs or, you know, a variety of things they're saying. The thought really is it's a defense against what they think is probably not going to be a favorable number because the Republican proposal is so different in many ways from the Affordable Care Act.
Well, I appreciate that it's different, but that doesn't necessarily make it worse. It sounds like they actually think they're going to get a bad score. And if I'm to believe the CBO, then there must be problems with it. What are the problems that everybody's anticipating?
For example, that the subsidies, these advanceable, refundable tax credits in the Republican bill are absolutely going to be lower in many cases for individuals who now may get some premium assistance from the Affordable Care Act. There's also going to be some people who benefit by those Republican subsidies because they are geared more on age than income. That's one area. Another area to look at is the fundamental change that the proposal would make to the Medicaid program. Again, this is the shared federal-state program that has about 70 million people on the rolls, the poor and disabled. But Medicaid also pays for half the births in this country and something like two-thirds of the nursing home care. So the Republican bill would shift it to a capped allotment, a set amount of money versus matching state spending on a percentage basis as it does now. So the thought is that that may lose mm-hmm. people to may cause people rather to lose their Medicaid coverage and shift a lot of those costs to state governments and possibly individuals.
Well, if I work for WGN Radio or Ace Hardware and I have Blue Cross Blue Shield or Cigna or one of those employer-provided programs, am I going to see a change, or is this just for people that are buying it on the exchange?
You might see some changes might touch you. For example, if the end result were that perhaps services that you now receive with no copay or out-of-pocket sharing, right, like
right.
preventative care or if you took your kids to the doctor, if that provision were changed, that might affect your particular plan. But as we know, our employers can make a lot of changes in our plans from year to year. They can drop the number of plans that are offered.
Right, but if I may, Mary Agnes, for instance, when I go to the doctor, I may pay a $10, $20, $50 copay, but it's manageable. And actually, mine is less than that. I mean, it's maybe $20. That's really nice. My prescription drugs are not that high. And when they tell you what it is, you know, I pay $30 for something, and then I find out it was $300. I thank my lucky stars I have a decent insurance plan. Many, many, many Americans do. If that's tweaked a little bit, I could live with that. But for those people, is it safe to say that their lives will not be that radically changed with this?
Not necessarily. Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't necessarily be changed from the Republican health plan itself. But the point I want to stress here is that employers make their own decisions every year
yeah.
about coverage.
Yeah.
And the exact thing you're talking about, instead of raising premiums, a lot of employers have been shifting those costs to employees in the sense of a higher deductible for drugs or an office visit, that kind of thing. So those are the changes that have been happening and may continue to happen that are separate from this current debate from the Republican proposal to overhaul the ACA.
But isn't the idea that they're going to give you some sort of rebate or some sort of tax credit for those costs that you pay out of pocket?
But that's only if you don't have an offer of employer coverage. If your employer is offering you coverage, you can't qualify for these rebates.
Understood. But for the people that are for the people that are using it, if they're using these tax credits, will they be better off in this new plan than they were under Obamacare?
Well, it depends. It depends on where you live. It depends on what your age is, and it depends on your income. And here's what I mean: the Affordable Care Act really geared these credits to one's income, right? What happens in the Republican alternative is they are really gearing it more to age with just a slight adjustment for income. Under the Republican plan, if you were 30 or under, you'd get a $2,000 tax credit. If you were 60 or older, you'd get a $4,000 tax credit. And there's no adjustment in the Republican plan for the local cost of insurance. Under the Affordable Care Act, or some people call it Obamacare, if you live in a high-cost area, that's figured in the subsidy, which is also adjusted for your income. Under the Republican proposal, again, it's mostly age. The only adjustment for income is those credits start to drop if you are an individual and you make more than $75,000 a year, or you're married and make more than $150,000. So if you are an older person who does not make a good income and lives in a high-cost area, that $4,000 tax credit is probably a lot less than you are currently receiving on the Affordable Care Act if you're getting a subsidy.
Mary Agnes Carey from Kaiser's on the line. You may have a question or a comment about all of this, and I've got some too still. If you want to join us, 312-981-7200. You can call or text to that number, 312-981-7200. We'll pick it up here in a minute on WGN. Got some texts. We'll read some of them, and we'll take some of your phone calls, too. 312-981-7200. Although I do just want to give a quick shout-out here because they've been in this studio so many times, and they listen to us in Honolulu and have been longtime WGN listeners. Welcome back, John Williams, Todd and Chrissy, listening to us on Oahu. Nice to hear from them. It's 224 on WGN. I'm John, and this is my new home. If you're just joining me for the first time or maybe the multiple time, I'm now on WGN Radio from 1 to 3 in the afternoon. Bill and Wendy are still on in the morning, and you'll be able to hear them starting tomorrow on the stream as well. Mary Agnes Carey, Partnerships Editor and Senior Correspondent with the Kaiser Health Group, is on the line. And we're talking about the CBOE. Actually, we're talking about the Republican plan for health care, for revising, repealing, and replacing Obamacare. Since we started that commercial break, to your knowledge, Mary Agnes, has the CBO come in with their numbers yet?
They have not. I just checked, and the thought is possibly this evening. So stay tuned.
Yeah, okay. Is this a number they'll come up with? How many people will lose coverage?
That's one of the numbers, sure. How many people will lose coverage? How many people could gain theoretically if they found that as well? What's it going to cost the federal treasury? What are the impacts on the Medicaid program? That's another one of the key areas we're watching.
And I guess that's just their educated guess. That's their best effort on what they think is going to happen, right?
Right. This is an agency full of some of the nation's best economists that are experts in predicting and analyzing congressional legislation. So this is something that has been used in agency for years in Washington, and people look to it and trust it.
Let's pick up a couple of phone lines. We'll start with, I think it's Debbie on line 3. You're on WGN. Go ahead, Debbie. What's your question?
My question regarding the Republican replacement is, they're talking about it being based on age rather than income. Will that then be more difficult for older people to get employment or maintain their employment?
I think they're two different things. If you have employment or you started a job, you would not be eligible for these tax credits. So the way to look at it is you've got the employer marketplace, where most of us, something like 160 million people in this country, get coverage for themselves and their dependents at work. That is separate from what the Republicans are talking about, which would be done for people who are in the individual market.
it seems to me, thanks for the call, Debbie. I hope that helps. Everybody should have coverage, or coverage that is so affordable that, you know, they have access to it. I know that's not written into the Constitution, but when I get to be King, Mary Agnes, everybody in America will have affordable health care. Would you say that they do that now? And would you say that this still allows for that?
I would say this. I would say that both Republicans and Democrats alike agree with you. They want people to have affordable health care coverage that takes care of their needs, takes care of their families and themselves. The biggest disagreement is over how to do it. Democrats have traditionally wanted to have a larger role for the federal government. Republicans want the government not to have the major federal role in the sense of prescribing whether or not you have to have insurance, how much it has to cover, how much it has to cost, what percentage of your income do you have to pay. Mm-hmm. Democrats tend to be more prescriptive, if you will, with a federal prescription, where Republicans are talking about a lot about this now, that they want to leave this up to individuals. Even the decision about whether or not to have coverage, most economists would tell you that you should have a mandate, a requirement that people have health insurance or pay a fine. And Democrats have felt that way. That's in the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
Many Republicans say, let's just add a surcharge to the premium to incentivize you to get in, but not require you to do so.
Should I read much into the fact that the AARP and the AMA and conservative and liberal groups are against this? I mean, maybe that happens all the time. Or is that noteworthy?
It is noteworthy in the sense that you've got the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association, as you mentioned, AARP and other groups, other physician groups coming out in opposition to this. I sort of see that, and I definitely pay homage to it. But the other reality we're dealing here with is the political reality. And we heard Speaker Ryan, Paul Ryan, talk about this, the Speaker of the House last week, as he's talking to his caucus, to Republicans. This is our best opportunity to pass this repeal and replace. We campaigned on it. We've got to do it. There's all these thoughts that they're going to get hammered, they being Republicans, in the 2018 midterms if they don't do this. So that also has an incredible push on members to see the opportunity, to see the timing. And let's face it, Republicans want to do a tax overhaul. That's going to take a lot of time and a lot of political capital. They want to do an infrastructure bill. They know that they've got a set amount of time, really, before they head into the midterm. So it's that political pressure is also incredibly dominant. And but absolutely, the fact that you've had all these medical groups come out in opposition to it, and these were all groups that the Obama administration courted to get support for the Affordable Care Act, it's going a very different way this time.
Lots of calls and questions for you. Let's do this. Can you join us maybe later this week after we get that report from the government? And maybe we've all had a chance to sort it out a little more this week. And we'll just take calls for you, Mary Agnes, and let people kind of get their specifics answered from you.
That'd be my pleasure.
Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
You got it. Thank you.
From Kaiser News, the health reporter, Mary Agnes Carey. Thank you, Steve. Bertrand, are you a bracket guy? I'm not going to do a whole big, gigantic bracket breakdown here, but will you be doing one?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Are you pretty good at it?
Absolutely not. No, I'm not. I won the first one I was ever in high school with a bunch of dads. I won it, and it's been downhill from there.
Mark Carman's in our studio, too. I like Marquette. I presume that's the team that you're rooting for, right?
Yeah, I was shocked that they made it. I didn't think they were going to make it in.
I don't think they're great, but I think they're good enough. I'm a Big East guy, and I think Marquette should be in the dance.
You're only a Big East guy because of Butler.
Yeah, they're going to win it all this year.
You got a little Wojo up there at Marquette there, Steve
How
Bertrand.
How about that Wojo and Duke in round two?
That's right, buddy.
If they beat South Carolina.
I got Butler winning two games and then losing probably to UCLA.
We weren't talking about Butler. We were talking about Wojo and Marquette.
There are other teams. And then you got yourself this whole Northwestern thing.
John, you look great in your Butler Bulldog sweatshirt.
I am wearing
today.
A Butler Bulldog sweatshirt today. Whoop, whoop, whoop.
Did I say congratulations first that you're back at WGN on a full-timer here? Congratulations,
That's
King John.
Nice of you to say. I used to visit with you and Harry Tynowitz on my Saturday afternoon show. After I was done, you guys would come on, and we would share a minute or two of crosstalk each day.
Yeah, I sent you a text saying, like, hey, man, you can't be leaving Saturdays. That was, like, my favorite part of the show.
It was kind of mine, too. It was the end of mine and the beginning of yours, and it was kind of fun to visit with you guys. In fact, I was listening to the two of you this weekend. So I'm driving down from Minneapolis. getting ready to move in here and get going on this show. And you guys were just cracking me up about a variety of things.
God bless you. Thank you for saying that. It's always fun. I love doing the show. I love doing it. Harry and I have a lot of fun. He's a gentleman and a scholar.
Well, you guys did, Bertrand, they did a whole segment on favorite Jay Cutler memories.
You opened the show with that?
Which I think is inspired.
Right. Is that wrong?
No, it's not. But I thought that you were going to get calls. So guys were calling in going, fourth quarter, remember the Detroit game when he threw the interception or stuff like that. I thought it was going to be more like I was at the mall with my kids. We said, hey, kids, there's the quarterback. I thought they were going to be those kind of Jay Cutler stories.
Yeah, I'm not going to.
Because I have some of those.
Do you really?
Well, friend of a friend. But okay. And they're not nice stories.
I ran into him in the Whole Foods one time.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, this will be good. Tell that story, Steve.
No, he just didn't. I mean, I didn't.
Did you come up to him and go, oh, my God, you're Jay Cutler?
No, it was pretty clear he knew. No, actually, in his defense, it was pretty clear he didn't really want to be talk to.
Well,
you know, it had the sort of hunched shoulders and the hood on and stuff. So
I always give those kind of people that space, right. You know, famous celebrity types.
I followed him for three aisles and then I thought, that's enough.
I like to stalk professional athletes, entertainers, the whole thing.
I don't know what he does with all that aspartame, but
I think I actually creeped out Charlie Hall yesterday at Northwestern, who's a walk-on on the basketball team, whose mom is Julie Louis-Dreyfus. Everybody knows the story by now. But I'm like, so can I meet your mom? Do you know Jerry Seinfeld? What about Kramer? Who can I talk to? What about George?
You guys, Steph Kramer, sell.
You guys were so – I listened to so much of that yesterday afternoon. It was so much fun.
Yeah.
To all of the stuff going on at Northwestern.
Steve, how long have you been at WGN Radio?
Forever.
Did you ever think that Northwestern basketball could ever be talked about for 4 hours in one show? I mean,
in a compelling way, mind you.
It was great. It was so much fun to be out there. And you know, to their student-athletes, these guys are super interesting coming up, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so when they were doing the camera shower, they say, now we cut to Northwestern, they all go, yay! Two of them had textbooks in their laps. I'm not making that up. They were studying while they were getting ready for the thing. At least that's the version I heard.
Did you guys
see that's not true, don't tell me otherwise.
I don't mean to change it here, but did you see the Princeton team behind their coach? Right before the announcement show?
No.
They're interviewing the coach, you know, and I'll hear this. He's a former player. I don't remember his name. But, here's a great fit, great leader, and you got these Princeton men, these super educated.
Yeah.
And they're, like, leaning back and hamming for the camera. And they looked like a bunch of 18-year-old kids. It was hilarious.
Well, I thought that the moment when they went to the Notre Dame team was interesting.
I didn't see it. I was very much immersed.
Because
but
everybody
ahead.
Loses their minds, even like Villanova. They're a one seed, and they all go, yay! They cut to Notre Dame, and they go, and in the such and such, Notre Dame.
Nothing.
They were too cool for school. And I'd like to think that was a technical thing and not an attitude thing. Maybe they didn't know, but they weren't really celebrating the moment.
Well, Nigel Hayes was doing the same thing with Wisconsin, 8 seed.
Well, you could have won your tournament.
Yeah,
he's a funny guy, though.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Oh yeah. He's hilarious.
Well, so just give me a couple of things that would be fun to watch for, then, Mark. Like this tournament, obviously, Northwestern's a Cinderella story. I'll just mention this: Minnesota wasn't in the NIT last year, and this year they could win a game or two.
Well, it was shocking that Minnesota was a 5 seed. I thought that was pretty generous.
That's very generous
for your Golden Gopher. I love the Michigan team, and I don't like Michigan at all.
Yeah,
and
it's a good story.
Derek Walton, the plane and the uniforms and all of it. Near tragedy, then winning the Big Ten tournament, wearing your practice jerseys in the first couple of games. I love their point guard, Derek Walton Jr. When they lost to Illinois, they were called out for being soft, a white-collar team, and this kid's from inner city Detroit. He's like, okay, we're having a team meeting right now. That ain't going to fly.
Oh, really?
So I do like Michigan. And the Cats, you know, it's just they have a great opportunity with Vanderbilt. That's a coin flip game. And then you get to play a one seed in Gonzaga, which if that's the best one seed to play, I would think.
Maybe ever. I think that is the fattest – that is the easiest one seed you'll ever face.
So we'll see. And Bryce Drew, head coach at Vanderbilt, in his first year, him and Chris know each other. They were texting each other during the game. Very similar stories there.
Do you think this is helpful? So I have some factoids about brackets.
Yeah.
Over the last 5 years, 11 and 12 seeds have won more games than 9 and 10 seeds in the opening round.
Oh, you're legit looking for strategy right now. I get it.
So make your brackets out, but then go back, and I think you should just score it against some of these things. Go, oh, no, wait, I have my 9 and 10s winning more than my 11 and 12s. That's logical. But I'm telling you, over the last 5 years, 11 and 12s win more opening round games than the 9 and 10s.
Okay, okay.
So just hopefully that helps you. Let me just throw one more at you.
But wait, but the 10s are playing 7s, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
What's your point?
Well, they're not favored to win those games either.
Yeah, but the 11 and 12s aren't necessarily favored to win their games either.
5-12, right.
It also, I mean, it does depend on the matchup. You can't just say that.
Well, but it's over 5 years. Okay, how about this?
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
In the last 5 years, the 5-12 game and that 6-11 game are 50-50 picks.
Right.
5-12, the 6 and 10 seeds have all won exactly 10 first-round games in the last 5 years. So, again, look at your brackets. Yeah, you've got to have at least 1-6 winning.
You want me to give you an 11
seed? Pardon me, 1-11 winning. Yeah, go ahead.
Rhode Island, coached by Danny Hurley of the Hurleys. They shoot it well. Yeah. They score the basketball. It's not just a three-point shooting team. They rebound it well, and they turn you over. So they're taking on Creighton. Very winnable game. I think that's a coin flip. And then they've got the Oregon and Iona.
Boy.
So I don't mind. If you want to take a flyer on Rhode Island, that's
really? Because I think Creighton's good. I think Creighton can play.
Okay. That's the beauty of the tournament. You don't like my Rhode Island pick, huh? I thought you were going to like that one.
Well, I'd like to like it, but I don't like Creighton.
Marquette, South Carolina.
South Carolina hasn't won a tournament game since 1973. Not that that matters to this team. I really like Frank Martin a lot, but I'm going to go with your Marquette. What are they, the Golden Eagles now?
It's been 20 years, Frank. Get used to it.
Move on.
I still can't get over it.
They're playing the Fighting Illini. Are you happy?
Right. I had to get rid of the Warriors. I mean, come on.
How about this? If you don't have many number one seeds in your Final Four, that's okay because as often as not, number ones don't make it to the Final Four. But of the last 28 number one seeds, only 8 have played in the Final Four.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, don't have too many number ones in there. And never has a team higher than 8 won at all. So don't have a 9 or a 12 or somebody winning it because that just never happens.
Right. You can, you know, if you're looking for a Cinderella to take the whole thing, pick a 4 seed, pick a 5 seed if you're really going to go that bold.
How about this one? Coaches with one syllable first names win 79% more games than multisyllabic name coaches, and no one named Mortimer has ever advanced beyond the Sweet 16.
I knew there was a reason I was invited in today, and it was to learn that.
Only twice has a coach married to someone named Poopsie won a tournament game.
Really?
So I don't know if you want to go that deep into the weeds, but that's just something for you.
Poopsie, huh?
And this is just one other thing that I've noticed. When you are kind of talking at the water cooler with your friends, if you say he's done a really great job with that program, you can justify anything that follows that or precedes that. Just like if you said, I think the St. Anthony 7th grade girls are going to beat Villanova. And they go, really? What are you, crazy? Go, no, I think Sister Margaret has really done a good job with that program. And they go, oh, she's really done a good job. If you know to drop that, really done a good job with the program, it sounds like you know stuff.
See, I must have blown it with Rhode Island. All I had to say was they've done a great job with that program.
And I would have gone, well, then they're going to be Creighton.
Right. But the way I did it, you're like, no, Creighton's crushing Rhode Island.
Try it again. Go ahead and give it to me.
You know, Danny Hurley's just done an amazing job with the Rhode Island program. I really like Rhode Island.
Well, then I'm taking Creighton right off of my bracket. I'm not even putting him in the tournament. See how that works? Yeah.
Final Four Rhode Island, even though that doesn't work in your original point that no team below an 8 has ever made it.
I want to ask you about Illinois State and Tim Tebow, not in that order, and not for the same reason, in a minute on WGN. All right, let's finish this bad boy up. This is John Williams. 252 on WGN. You can hear me now weekdays from 1 to 3 and Saturdays 10 to noon on WGN Radio. Mark Carmen's in the studio just kind of helping us with our brackets a little bit, but just kind of catching up with an old friend for that matter. Illinois State is not in the tournament.
It's really disappointing for Dan Mueller and company, who won 27 games, whose RPI was 33, who went 17-1 in the conference, and his tweet to, hey, anybody in the Big Ten, anybody in the ACC, anybody want to play me on a home-and-home, you can play a team with an RPI of 33. I mean, he's basically saying that nobody will play the Redbirds, and that's why they were in the position of not having any great wins.
RPI 33 isn't good enough to get you in the tournament?
There's only 10 schools in the history of the tournament with that level of RPI that haven't made it. So it's one of the all-time great snubs, and they're the number one seed in the NIT.
It just pays no respect to Illinois State or that conference that they play in.
Right.
Because there was a day when Illinois State and Bradley was such a big game, and I miss those days. I miss the days when Illinois State was really a basketball team that mattered. But this would have put them on the map. Now just going to win the NIT, right?
I guess. I mean, the last time they were in the tournament, 1998, Mueller was a player there, and now he's coaching. That's a hard one to stomach. I mean, if you're a senior, right, and you put all that effort in, you don't get to go, if you've gone 27-6.
Well, you know who was on their team when they were really good? Matt Taphorn.
Is that right?
Matt Taphorn was a stud for Illinois State, and Hersey Hawkins was a stud, and those guys for Bradley. I don't remember if they played against each other. I think they may have. I'm pretty sure they did.
Okay.
It was that era. I mean, that was a long time ago, but it was really fun. So I love watching the Taphorn connection come all the way around.
Yeah. With Dave making the pass against Michigan, the whole thing. Hersey was great back in the day, man. That was a lot of fun for Bradley back then.
Somebody said Tim Tebow is still playing baseball.
It's the number one story right now on ESPN. That's kind of interesting that Tim Tebow got his first spring training hit. There he goes. Tebow with a knock, John. Let's see.
Is he playing for the Mets?
He's playing for the Mets. He was hitless in his first 8 at-bats, but then he got an opposite field single on a 2-2 pitch, bottom of the 5th. Then he was doubled.
Did he play? Really?
He's a double play grounder, but he was doubled off the other day when he got on. After he gets beaned, he's on first, line drive. Tebow, first step towards second. Caught, you're out.
Really?
Thrown behind him.
Yeah. Did he play A-ball or high A-ball? Did he play any kind of baseball last year?
He was in the fall league, and he's going to play some minor league ball this coming year.
Are they
year.
Projecting him to be a minor leaguer of any consequence?
I don't think so, no.
So then why do they have him? Just because it's fun to have Tim Tebow?
Well, the World Baseball Classic's going on right now, so a lot of guys, like the Mets have 15 guys that are playing in it, so it opened up an opportunity for him to get into some spring training games. But to what you're saying, yes, I'm sure there's some publicity stunt to it as well. But you know what? Hey, man.
I'm not mad at him for trying.
Right?
I would try, and I don't care if people want. People say bad things about everybody all the time for everything, so you can't listen to that.
Right. I agree. Hey, man, you want to go play? You're an incredible athlete, 99.9% better than everybody else. Go ahead.
And if you can't play Major League Baseball, Michael Jordan couldn't either. There's no shame in that, right?
Right. Although Mike was on his way. He was hitting like 270 in the fall league, and then they had that whole, like, you know, if he wanted to come back and play, I think he would have made it, John, just a couple more years.
You think Jordan could have played Major League Baseball?
I think he was better
than the way he was trying at that time in his career?
I think he was better than people gave him credit for. That's all I want to get out there.
Do you buy any of the conspiracy theories about why Michael Jordan was playing baseball?
No.
You're not into that at all?
Absolutely not. I think his dad got murdered, and he was in a significant morning, and he was burnt.
And so he didn't want to play basketball and then thought, I'm going to give baseball a try.
Well, you know, his dad always wanted him to play baseball. That was the story. So it was a way for him to connect with his dad. And when he hit his first home run, he pointed to the sky and all that type of stuff. I think it was a way for him to be with his father.
You were talking about the World Baseball Classic. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
I was watching TV last night or the night before. Ryan Dempster pitching for Canada.
Good for him.
Got drilled.
Yeah, well, did you see the video of him and Theo?
No.
So is it spring training? He's getting himself loose for the World Baseball Classic, and Theo is in the cage taking swings off him, and he rips one to right field. It's like, yeah, that's not a great sign.
That's not
for
a
Demp.
Good sign.
Yeah, no.
So how old is Dempster now?
Demp is, he's got to be, what, 43? I'm guessing.
What is that all about? Is he a legitimate World Baseball Classic pitcher or whatever that thing is?
Probably not, but it's Canada, and they don't have a super deep roster, apparently.
I was happy for him. Again, I thought, I know he didn't do well.
He's 39, right?
And he didn't look great, and he was grooving him and blah, blah, blah. But I thought, what the hell? Give it a shot.
I mean, I'm pro playing things as long as you can play them. 75-year-olds that are out there in some league doing something good for you.
I posted on my Facebook page, Mark, I got to let you go. We're wrapping it up here. Rose right around the corner. But I posted on my Facebook page a bunch of these, how many 12s you should have versus 5s, how many 11s versus 6s. Don't pick anybody past an 8. Just some tips for your brackets. So I know you need, you know, advice from me, but
I'm going right there, John.
There's some statistical help there that may do you some good. It's nice to see you, my friend.
Thank you for having me. Great to see you back, John.
When do people hear you on this fine radio station again?
I will be on. I'm actually going to be filling in for Dave Bennett doing sports on the mornings this week with the Dave with the Wildcats, and then I'll be on Saturday and Sunday with the Beat. It's regular time. Well, the regular time now is 4:00. On Saturdays, 3:00 on Sundays.
Okay, I'm done. I'm out of the way. Ro, I presume you and who all you got over there, Ro?
Well, we've taken the entire team to Mexico, John.
Wow!
And That is, there are 124 people, and we have 14 listeners because we actually carry 110 staff with us wherever we go. So it's it really is something special here. We're very, very glad that.
Well, you picked a good day to get out of town. You know, we're looking at snow here.
You know, it's funny you should mention that, John, because we're going to lead off the show with some more of the weather facts that are happening here. This is been a conversation that many of the listeners who are with us have had with us. They're showing pictures that their relatives are sending from home, and it didn't snow at all, as you know, you're well aware. You know this winter we had no measurable snow in January and February.
Yeah.
But now that spring is upon us, it's time now to get walloped a whole foot, and here it's 89 degrees and sunny.
So where exactly are you right now?
None of your business.
Because I'm going to pray for snow wherever you is.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to keep it a secret now. Although that's the name of the place we're at, actually, a secret's in Huatulco. So that's how that works out. So, hey, welcome aboard, John. Welcome back to WGN.
That's nice of you.